everyone, it's Angela Stevens, and I am the podcast host to Refocus with Angela. And I'm so excited today because I've got one of the coolest guests that I think I've ever interviewed before. I read his bio before, and it's very, very impressive. But today we have Eric Maisel. He is an author, he's a speaker, he's a coach, and more importantly, he's a creativity coach. I think that's the best way to describe him. And he has a terrific background. But first of all, Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great being with you, Angela. I'd love to be here. Hope we can keep this alive as we have big winds outside. So if the power goes off, it's not me being rude.
Okay. So now where are you based?
30 miles east of San Francisco, Bay Area.
No kidding. Love the Bay Area. Awesome. Okay. Well, if you do, we'll just start over when you call back. So, but thank you so much. So first of all, I know people are going to say creativity coach. Now there's a lot of coaches out there, right? So what is a creativity coach?
Yeah, the simple way to say it is a life coach for creative folks. Creative and performing artists have their particular issues, whether it's marketplace issues or whether it's getting the work done, resistance to the work, blockage. There are all kinds of characteristic issues that creatives face. And creativity coaches are trained to work with those issues and help creative folks get their creative work done and also move it out into the marketplace.
You know, that's fascinating. Because the types of people that you work with, I would assume they're writers or they're actors or performers. Is that right?
Clowns, mimes. Yes.
So tell us, I love theater and I love acting and all of that. But tell us, what is the main thing or one of the top maybe two things that people come to you and say, Eric, I'm really struggling today with?
For a, let's say a writer, it's getting the work done. It's showing up to the work. And for a performer, it's performance anxiety, typically. Most performers experience performance anxiety, some at a very low level, so it's not a tremendous issue. But maybe 25, 30, 40% of performers experience it at enough of a level that they need to figure out what to do about it, different from taking anxiety drugs for it. And there are plenty of things to try, and I've got lots of menu items for them to try, but it would be performance anxiety for performers and getting the work done for creatives.
You know, I can truly relate. When you have a business and sometimes you got to make those sales calls or you got to go in. If you have a business, you don't have a boss standing over you. For me, I was a single mom for 10 years and I worked an all commission job. Would I recommend that? No, but we do what we have to do and we have to figure out what works for us.
And typically there's no real deadline for many of these things. If you practice on a given day, that's up to you. If you write on a given day, that's up to you. And so if there's anxiety threading through the process, the number one thing we do if we're anxious is to flee the encounter. We get out of there. So that's why so many creative and performing artists aren't practicing their guitar or doing their writing, is that there's just a little bit of anxiety there. And what they want to do is get away from that anxiety so they don't show up to the work.
Wow. So is one of the areas to rejection? Do they struggle with rejection?
Rejection and all of the related ideas like criticism and pushback. And so Freud said that he thought that all blockage was self-censorship. Now, all blockage is not self-censorship, but that's a big deal item. And you can imagine if you're a memoir writer and you're trying to decide if you really want to put down on paper this thing about your sister or your father or the butcher or about anybody, if you really want to reveal anything, that provokes anxiety, and you're probably going to censor yourself. That's why memoirists take so long to get their books done, 15, 20 years, and they never get them done. They haven't actually resolved that basic question of whether they want to reveal themselves or not.
Wow, that's really interesting. So I got a question for you. So my son, you know, all of our products are created through the eyes of a child with ADHD, and he's now in college. But when he was younger, he was a child actor. And if you remember the plush animals at Hallmark and they had the voice singing, well, he was the voice of the Hallmark Q-Pig. So the Q-Pig shuffle, only Q-Pig shuffle. And it was so cute. And they came out for 4 years. I think he made $150 off of that being non-union, right? Yeah, exactly. But he, it's followed him all the way up to college in embarrassing moments and good moments. But the reason I say that is he was in Los Angeles and we took him to a lot of auditions. And one thing I did, and you can tell me as a mother if this was a good idea or not, we would go on an audition And he would come out and I said, okay, now what do we do? And I would always have him rip up the script and throw it away. And I said, okay, we're done. And if we get called back, we deal with it then. And many people, you know, whether they like that idea or not, I just didn't want him to really dwell on how did he do, what did he do wrong at that age. And he looks back on that. And I think he found that to be very helpful.
I think it's a great idea. I think it's very smart. There's a branch of psychology called psychosynthesis, and one of their big ideas is disidentification. And what it's sort of like detachment in Buddhism, but the idea is to separate yourself from temporal experiences like an audition. So to immediately say, well, the audition may not have gone well, but I'm still a wonderful person.
Right.
Rather than moving from the audition didn't go well, and that means I'm a stupid person or a bad person or an untalented person. So I think that mechanical tearing up the script is a disidentification technique, which is smart.
Great. Thank you. You know, I really appreciate that, because looking back, I didn't know if that was the right thing or not. But as I've been an actor myself, an audition, you can really beat yourself up inside and
that's
think
right.
that people don't even like you. And that's a very unhealthy space to be in.
That's right. And creatives, performers, they forget that they're competing with so many people, and that the people hiring them are actually looking for someone in particular, not the best person, but the right person. And what is rightness? That's all in the director's eyes.
Exactly. So could you give us a couple of ideas? So if somebody is listening to this podcast, and let's say they have to go on an audition or they have to do a speech and they're really struggling with anxiety, what is one thing or two that they could do? I know that they should call you and book a session with you, of course, and we'll put that on the podcast. But just like immediate things, what can someone do to tame that anxiety?
The first thing is be prepared. As many actors have said, learn your lines. It being unprepared provokes anxiety. So being prepared is a big deal one. I believe in visualizations. I have a book of many visualizations called Redesign Your Mind. The idea there is to picture your mind as a room and to actually redesign it and redecorate it. And one of the visualizations includes when you enter the room, when you flip on the switch for the light, that doubles as a calmness switch. So every time you enter your mind, you flip that switch and immediately get calmer. If that visualization doesn't work for you, then it doesn't work. But if it does, you can have an instant way of getting calmer just by visualizing that switch being
awesome.
Flipped.
Now, I want to be clear on this. So they visualize a switch and it's the calming light, but their life inside, is it pictures of their life of where they've been?
No, it's an actual room. No, you enter the room, you install windows so a breeze blows through so you don't have such a stuffy inner life. You get rid of that bed of nails that so many people live on. You replace it with an easy chair.
I love that.
Et cetera. It's physically redesigning the room that is your mind so that is the place you want to be. Most people don't want to be in their own mind
right. Because
it's a self-pestering place or an anxious place.
Right. Right.
So cognitive therapy, you know, teaches us to change our thoughts. This, I think, goes a step further. This changes the source of our thoughts. So we start to think new thoughts. That's why I think redesigning our mind is a cool idea.
I truly love that, actually. Like I said, I read his bio and it's amazing. And he's actually written the Rethinking Mental Health blog for Psychology Today. What do you write about on there?
Well, I believe in and belong to folks who have three names for what they do: critical psychology, critical psychiatry, and anti-psychiatry. We don't really know which label we like the best. But the main point is we disagree with the American Psychiatric Association model of mental disorders. We don't believe that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, is a real honorable, legitimate book, but rather a shopping guide for psychiatrists. So you can tell where I'm coming from there. And that's what Rethinking Mental Health is about, shifting the conversation from a pseudo-medical model of mental disorder to a problems in living model of difficulty or distress.
Wow.
Not unlike what you're doing with here are things you can actually use. Mm-hmm. Different from medicine, different from chemicals. Here are different sorts of things you can do. If you have a particular challenge, here are things to do to help with the challenge, rather than to act like it's a medical specialty.
Right. And we'll give the audience a sneak peek of, I had asked him where he kept his passwords and he wrote them down. And we have 11 versions of password books. And he's so sweet that he said, I want you to send that to my wife. So that just, that tells you so much about you as a person. I want to talk about you for a minute. So how do you, if you're having a bad day and like your day's not, you know, it's just not organized and you just kind of don't feel right. How do you organize yourself in the daytime? What type of things do you do?
Well, on a practical level, it's just taking little breaks. I believe in short breaks, not leaving the encounter completely, understanding that you're returning. I think that's an important point because you can sort of go out the door and be done for the day and then not come back to your work. And I don't want to do that. So I have little 2-minute things I know to do, like make popcorn takes 3 minutes and 20 seconds to make. I know exactly those sorts of things that allow me to take little breaks. But it's more attitude. It's more reminding myself why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I think so many people nowadays have lost the plot.
Right.
They're not sure what matters or if they matter or if what they're doing matters. We can all feel that. So when we have that experience, when that comes over us, like, this doesn't matter, or why am I doing this? And we have to kind of redon the mantle of meaning maker. We have to say, I make my own meaning. I have to announce my own life purposes. I have to get back in the saddle. It's essentially a self-conversation. It's an ongoing daily self-conversation about I'm continuing to show up.
Right. Absolutely. And also, as we were talking, sometimes you don't have a boss telling you, hey, you've got to get this done, especially in the creative world, right? You've got to be your own cheerleader.
That's right. And or you may have deadlines, but they're in the distant future. Like if I have a book contract deadline, it might be mid-year next year. So I can act like that's no deadline at all. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like getting your college paper done at the last minute. You had a deadline all along, but you didn't take it seriously until the last split second.
So exactly. And we've all been there.
A lot of creative and performing artists have deadlines, but they're far in the distance. It's that painting show 2 years from now. So it's not an imminent deadline.
Correct. So a quick question on that. We have a lot of people that call us and say, you know, my mother or my son is struggling with Alzheimer's or things like that. And, you know, as the aging population, look at you, you're still going. And my parents worked their whole life. My mom is still working and she's 81 years old. But for people who are, you know, either retired or hitting that older market, they're having trouble with dementia and they kind of feel like, you know, whether it's writing that book or whether it's performing, that maybe I'm done, right? Maybe it's time to hang that up. Have you had people come to you like that?
Sure. It's a centerpiece of what I do, helping people make, there are two paradigm shifts I believe in. One is the shift from the idea of seeking meaning, that it's out there somewhere, to the idea of making meaning. I think it's on our shoulders to make meaning, that it's not out there anywhere. And then the shift from the idea of the purpose of life to the idea of multiple life purposes, that many things are important to us. So I try to help anybody of any age identify what's still important to them or what can again be important to them. Because maybe some of the things that's important to a 70-year-old or an 80-year-old are not the things that used to be important. Maybe it used to be career and now it's service, but maybe they haven't thought through this shift from prior purposes to contemporary purposes. So that's easy work to do. It's easy for a person. They may not get it at the first go around as to identify what's important, but even just this conversation helps.
Yeah. You know, my mom always told me, always have something to look forward to. You know, and she's living. She's lost her husband and her son, and she's living, and it's a choice, right? So I think that's very fascinating.
Yeah, and in addition to something to look forward to, something to love, because we're a little squeamish about using the love word, but I think we do need to love things. And I think we fall in love purely when we're 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, whether it's with reading or with music or with film, or We fall in love without having, we don't have to be told why it's fun to read a book. We just know it's enjoyable. We have those early loves, and then we kind of lose that loving feeling somewhere along the line. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another one of the things that a coach and a client get to discuss is, What would you like to love now? And you may have to impose the love to begin with. You may have to fake it till you make it, because you may not, because something that you love may be difficult to accomplish. So it may not be an easy ride, but by trying it, you may discover that it really was an opportunity.
Interesting. You know, I'm a research hound. I love doing research. We had a woman wrote into us and we asked questions. If you have questions, let us know. One of the questions was this, and I just want to throw it out to you, because she said that my biggest challenge is with my son. He never likes to read. I can't get him to read. He's in middle school, and reading, she was very passionate about that, that creates a person. If you got parents, and I know we have parents on this podcast, so any advice for them on those situations?
No, I think, I mean, I do think we have to go with what our child's loves are. I mean, it's a little hard to just force or impose mm-hmm. what we think one should love or what we think one should be interested in. But I think let me say it one way. I was the house husband for our kids. And so I clearly modeled writing, even when they were in a playpen. And then they got to sort of write beside me, so to speak, even when they were very young. So I wouldn't say, it's a silly way to say it, that you would model reading, but just to keep expressing your enthusiasm for reading, how much you love it, and to just sort of get your child to be curious about why you love it so much might be a way in. Ultimately, all human beings decide what's important to them or what interests them. But if you're trying to sell a kid on something, I think the way to sell it is to do it yourself.
And that's called, a lot of that's called mirroring, right? And I did that with my son. You sit down at the table with a book or whatever, and then they will join you because they want to be where we are, right? And at a certain age, and then they don't. But I could talk to you for hours, but I do want to mention that Eric has a new book coming out, and I believe it is coming out called The Coach's Way. And did you say it's in April 23?
Comes out in April, late April. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. And they can get it at Amazon, or where can they get it?
Anywhere they get books, they can get it. And what's interesting about it, it's not just for coaches. It's for people who are thinking about being the client of a coach. It just looks very, very carefully and specifically at what goes on in sessions, how a session begins, what the middle of a session is, how it ends, what goes on between sessions. So I think it's a pretty good introduction to coaching for anybody who's interested in coaching.
Wonderful. I love that. Like I said, I could talk to you forever, but I got one last question for you. We ask all of our guests this. If you are on your way to a presentation, but it's just one of those days and all of your little tips, nothing's going right. It's just one of those days. And you're in the car or the train, you're going to prepare and do that speech or whatever that might be. How do you get game on? What is the song or the genre or the artist that you listen to in music that you listen to?
I'm going to give you three. I know that's a lot. Mm. Motown, reggae, and Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. A brown eyed girl. We used to sing sha la 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 la, just like that.
My favorite. What is it? Leaving on a Train in Georgia. What is that?
Yes, I think that might be
Gladys Knight. Yeah, that's one of my favorite. Knight.
Didn't you want to be a pip?
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't want to be a pip.
Oh, there you go.
Unfortunately, many of the folks may not know what a pip is.
No, I was going to say, I know our younger audience doesn't. So you want to explain what that is?
Just that was the backup group of Gladys Knight, the Pips.
And the Pips. Yeah, exactly. When you said it, it didn't register, but now it did. So anyway, Eric, it's such a pleasure having you today. I thank you so much for being on our podcast. Definitely, we want to talk to you again. But again, I graciously thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Refocus the Creative Office. You know, many people don't stop and take a moment to leave a review on their products or an experience. It helps companies out more than you can imagine. If you have purchased our products at different websites, whether it's Amazon, Walmart, Wayfair, Staples.com, wherever you purchased it, or our website, please leave a review. We would love to get your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. But also, leave a review at other websites. It helps so many people, especially if it's positive. Let's spread that positivity around. But no matter what, have a great week, and don't forget to stop, take a moment, and refocus.